Do you have a tattoo? Body art has gone mainstream, but did you know that tattooing was banned in Massachusetts for 38 years? And before then, one family sort of lived the history of tattooing from its days in the traveling sideshow to the rowdy world of Boston's Scully Square. An historic New England exhibit is excavating that story. And for our latest edition of Hidden History, we spoke with Darren Bray and Margaret Hodges. They are co-curators of the exhibit and authors of the book Loud, Naked, and in Three Colors, The Liberty Boys and the History of Tattooing in Boston. We joined them yesterday and started by asking what drew them to the history of tattooing.
It's a topic that has always interested me, and Boston, for whatever reason, has been overlooked by the scholarly world. So Peggy and I rolled up our sleeves and spent about 7 years putting this together.
I didn't realize there was a scholarly world about tattooing, and I don't mean that facetiously. I didn't know. Where is that scholarly world and what is usually studied?
Sure. Tattoo history is, I would say, still in its infancy, but there are university professors, programs that deal with different aspects of it. And it's sort of just coming into its own, I would say, over the last 10, 15 years, where you have these dedicated monographs and exhibits. And we're, you know, happy and proud to have sort of add Boston to that list.
Peggy, what intrigues you about the subject?
I am particularly attracted to learning challenges. And this was an extremely steep learning curve for me. And it captured all of the things that I particularly love, which is research and sort of anthropological, ethnological level studies, which is studying small groups, often groups that are outside of the norm, from a historical perspective.
So speaking of outside of the norm, Darren, I think some people, I was surprised to find out that tattooing was actually banned in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for 38 years, 1962 to 2000. Why? And was that unusual?
It was not that unusual. There are several other states, New York, Connecticut, that all banned tattooing around the same time. They all sort of cite the same reasons. They claim hepatitis outbreaks, it's unsanitary. Really, I think it was done under the guise of urban renewal and trying to clean up downtowns. And that's what happened in Boston. And they, of course, came in with the heavy equipment and they razed Scully Square, where all the tattoo artists were located. And the tattooers moved either underground or across state lines.
So I want to put a pin in the Scully Square part of this.
Sure.
Because I want to dive deeply into it. But I want to start with the thread that the two of you choose to follow, Peggy, which is one family, a father and three sons, who managed to be tattooing in Boston, basically, for decades. So tell us about the Liberty Men.
The Liberties began with Edward Dad Liberty. He was an immigrant from Canada, and he came originally to Lowell. He had mechanical skills, and he worked various odd jobs. He was very much a working-class person. His whole family was. And he found his way into tattooing because of other businesses that his family was involved in, such as small storefront shows that provided inexpensive kind of unusual entertainment to men. They included peep shows and exotic animals and things like that. So that was kind of how he ended up kind of falling into tattooing. And from there, once he married and started a family, he had three sons who, over the course of the decades, followed him into the trade. And by the 1940s, all of those men were working in Scully Square, and they just sort of cornered the market. There just really was no more room, or there wasn't a lot of breathing space for anyone other than a Liberty into the middle of the 20th century.
So you started early on in that answer, Peggy. You talk about the unusual sort of the shows, entertainment, et cetera, available for men, out of which the tattoo industry, at least in Boston, kind of emerged. And I'm looking through the book here fairly early in the book. You have images of men that would have been known as the tattooed man at a carnival or a sideshow.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, Darren, that you talk about in the book is this idea that the tattoo artist could come off the carnival stage and then make more money than actually giving people tattoos, which I'd never really thought of before. It wasn't just a sideshow. It was, quote unquote, a sideshow and then become a member of the show.
That's right.
And that is fascinating.
Yes, it really is because of carnivals, circuses, sideshows that tattooing became popular across America, because these traveling shows would go from town to town. The tattooed man would do his shtick, then step off the stage and tattoo the spectators. Mm-hmm. And he made a much better living doing that. Some people would walk away with tattoos, but they would also be introducing the sort of process and techniques of tattooing. And that's where a lot of the sort of what I would call the first generation of professional tattooers got exposure to the trade.
So that, Peggy, then, is how we wind up with Ed Liberty in a storefront in Scully Square. He sees this that Darren's talking about. He buys the tattooing equipment, and electrical tattooing was a big innovation, yes?
Yes, it was. And that was really the step that moved tattooing away from spectacle, which was the spectacle of the tattooed person displaying him or herself. Once electric tattooing was introduced, it became much more mainstream and became something that you could actually put into a storefront.
And, throughout the book, I've got it in front of me now, throughout the book we see pages and pages of sketches of tattoo designs. I have many reactions to them, a lot of breasts, lot of Native American imagery that I was very surprised about. There's some racist and uncomfortable imagery, lots of animals, and very few colors, actually.
Well, the limited color options is interesting. And that the reason the name of the book is Loud, Naked, and in Three Colors is because the Liberties and all tattoo artists of that time period only used 3 to 5 colors. You don't really see a lot of new colors introduced until sort of mid-century, the 60s, 70s. And so that's why a lot of the hand-painted tattoo flash or flash art, which is what it's known as today, that's why they are painted in a limited, in just a few colors.
Red, blue, green, black.
Red, blue, green, brown, wow. Yes.
And Peggy, what about the imagery?
Tattoo imagery is kind of by its nature appropriative. It borrows from all aspects of popular culture. Whatever is in the minds and eyes of the larger populace and the general populace finds its way into tattoo design. So we see a lot of imagery coming from, of course, the start of tattooing, which was on board ships. So there's a great deal of naval and sailor imagery. And then as we get into wartime, a lot of the wartime imagery ends up coming into tattooing as well. And this is where you get kind of the girly and the sometimes the more offensive and disturbing racial imagery is often associated with wartime.
So World War II then became, Darren, a booming time for tattooing, for the Liberty brothers and father in Scully Square. Really remarkable stuff in the book about people wanting something like their Social Security number
right.
tattooed on their body before they go to war. Story about somebody wanting they were a victim of a concentration camp, wanting that tattoo removed after the war. Talk a little bit more about war and tattooing.
Right. Well, oftentimes people consider that the World War II era, the sort of the golden era of tattooing, because tattoo shops were just packed, mostly with young men. And so they were just, sit them in the chair and tattoo them as fast as they could and move on to the next one. And so during that period, the Liberties and many other tattoo artists made a very good living.
And then, of course, now we get to reform. And this is where Scully Square comes back into. So now it's the 1950s. As regulations become more restrictive, and, of course, as the wild red lightness of Scully Square comes into question, as the city of Boston wants to do not only urban renewal, but claim an entire neighborhood of Boston that abuts Scully Square, the West End, and raise it in order to lay out a new government center. There's a lot. You talked about anthropology, Peggy. There's a lot of anthropology there.
There certainly is. A lot of, kind of laying bare of power structures as the city decides that it is going to remake the face of that part of the city. buying up all of the properties, paying the owners relatively little for their property, and effectively becoming their landlords and eventually evicting them.
That's right. Yes. So I would imagine all the tenants of Scully Square buildings got those letters. We're fortunate that the Liberty family still has the letters that Lefty Liberty got. But yeah, they announced, you know, he had to start paying rent to the city and then he had to be out by a certain date. And along with those letters, we actually have his business ledger from that time period, which he annotated with little notes. And business was just very difficult during that stretch. And he was nervous that after he left Scully Square that his customers would never find him again, which is, of course, not what happened.
He went to New Hampshire and they found him.
They found him, and he did better in New Hampshire than he had ever done in Boston.
But in the meantime, 1962 rolls around, and by then we've already seen restrictions on who can get tattooed. The age limit has been raised to 21. And then the Commonwealth of Massachusetts bans tattooing. We talked about that a little bit at the beginning. How do we then get to a point in 2000 where tattooing becomes legal again?
You know, our interest sort of stops in 1973, but what we do know, and that's
we don't
when,
want to know anything after
yeah,
that.
That's when Lefty Liberty passes away and retires, and he is Boston's last professional tattoo artist before the ban. But there were a series of efforts, unsuccessful, to overturn that ban, you know, over the years, and then in 2000. I think a couple of tattoo artists from Massachusetts, along with the tattoo artists from New York who wanted to relocate to Massachusetts, they just put in the effort to have that reexamined. And, of course, the ban was lifted as it should have been. But it's oftentimes always a surprise to people when they hear that tattooing has only been legal in Massachusetts since the year 2000.
So attitudes towards tattoos have changed so much. There was a time when in medical schools, medical students were taught that more than three tattoos on a body indicated antisocial behavior. Now you come forward to today with the vibrancy of tattoo culture. And Darren Bray, why is it important for us to know about this piece of Boston's hidden history?
This project was important to Peggy and I because we are in sort of the last hour of being able to capture this information. The people, Edward Liberty started tattooing during World War I. We spent a lot of time with his grandchildren. They're all approaching 90 now. And, you know, it's the same with Scully Square. The people who remember Scully Square fondly, you know, there are not many of them left. So for us, it was important to do this now while it could still be done. But it's also important to sort of put a stamp on, you know, sort of for Boston to sort of put its flag in the ground because it had this really important, rich history in the, you know, tattooing that just hadn't been documented. And so usually it gets overlooked for places like New York City or Los Angeles. But what was happening here in Boston was important, and we wanted to bring that to light.
Darren Bray and Margaret Hodges, co-curators of an exhibit for Historic New England on the Liberty family and the history of tattooing in Massachusetts. And that exhibit is on display at the Eustace Estate in Milton until October 30th. So what about today? Oh, I'm so glad you asked, because Damon Butler is a tattoo artist working at Empire Tattoo in Quincy here in Studio 2 and going to bring us forward to today. Welcome, Damon.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm great. It was fun to watch your face listening to that history, Damon. So let's just get your reactions.
It was very interesting for me to hear, especially how they kind of stopped being interested with the history of tattooing after 1973. But, you know, for tattooing to be legal in Massachusetts by 2000, it was, you know, they're right. You tell a lot of people, they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, before then you had to go up to New Hampshire, to Rhode Island, to Connecticut to get work done.
How did you become a tattoo artist? And is that the right term? Would I call you a tattoo artist?
Tattoo artist, that's fine. Or a tattooer.
Okay.
I got into it. I was a mentor over at a nonprofit arts and entrepreneurship organization called Artists for Humanity. I was there for many years, and one of my mentees had mentioned it to me one day. He was getting ready to leave, and I asked him, I was like, what are you getting ready to do? He's like, I'm getting ready to go home to tattoo. And I'm looking at him like, excuse me? Asked him a lot of questions. It sparked my interest. There came a time when I just needed some extra money, so I ended up picking up tattooing.
So I find it really interesting. Later on, you wind up on a TV show, Ink Master, and here's some sound from it. This is season 4 in 2014.
My name is Damon Butler. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts, and I've been tattooing for 3 years. My style of tattooing is a little bit of black and gray Chicano, a little bit of new school, a little bit of neo-traditional, with a whole lot of me in there.
So that's 8 years ago. You're smiling. That's 8 years ago. Has your style changed? Does that still describe who you are as a tattoo artist?
Yes. I do my best to keep it as varied as possible to be able to accommodate a lot of people who want a lot of different things. They may want traditional. They may want something that's black and gray. They may want, nowadays, a lot of people want something that's called fine line.
What is that?
It's just done with pretty small needles. It's done pretty small on the skin. It's nothing big or as ornate as a lot of, say, like a full sleeve that you might see on certain people. Just very small, very intricate little tattoos. And it's just to stay adept with the times.
So, you know, there's so much that's interesting about where we are today in the tattoo industry. The history we heard about, the marginalization at Scully Square, it's a particular quote-unquote part of Boston. Mm-hmm. You're on a national television show about tattooing, and it is a common part of our culture now. Does any of what you heard about from the history resonate to what you experience as a tattooer today?
In regards to?
Well, whether it's the images or it's, the sense that there's a performative nature to this. Or, hey, no, I can make the kind of money that there's enough room now that four people couldn't corner an entire market in a city.
Right. And, there's a lot of people who are in it now. There are women who tattoo. There are black, brown. Everyone is tattooing, is able to tattoo now. It's no longer just cornered to this seedy part of the city that was, only in one part. Now everyone everywhere is able to have access to it and able to receive the imagery that they want to get. It's no longer just, pick 1, 2, 3, 4 off that flash sheet, off that, sheet. The flash sheet is a collection of images.
Of options, basically.
Of options, pretty much. That's on a wall in a tattoo shop that a lot of times the artists themselves create. And so because of the internet, our options are completely and utterly unlimited.
You can work with anyone's flash sheet from anywhere.
Everywhere. And oftentimes, because I do have an artistic background myself, I'm able to just create, people are able to dictate the type of imagery that they want, and I'm able to illustrate it.
So I'm also thinking, Loud, Naked, and in 3 colors, right, was the story we heard, the limited number of colors that tattoo artists use. You're a man of color doing tattooing. I was thinking about recently the controversy around photographer Annie Leibovitz, who photographed Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson for Vogue in September, and tons of criticism that her skill set she doesn't know how to photograph black skin and doesn't know how to use the backlight that will enhance beauty and color. How do you, as a tattooer of color, innovate or change in order to use tones and use images that really honor all the skin tones of people who may come to you?
A lot of it starts with just educating people right up front. If I get someone who is a brown skin, I let them know right up front, hey, listen, these colors that you see, that you will see on a white skin, will not appear on your skin in the same manner. So let's set up your expectations realistically. And once they understand that, then they're like, okay, cool. So then we go on to create whatever imagery that they want. So a lot of what I do is to honor the tone of their skin, no matter what their tone is. May it be from super Irish all the way down to a dark African. Any and everything in between, just to be able to honor what they are looking to have, to be able to execute it in a way that is clear and concise and beautiful across all those skin tones, that's my goal.
Do you love what you do?
Absolutely.
Why?
It's the everyday challenge. I'm an artist. I love being able to figure out how can I, render someone's idea beautifully. And everything that comes with that, and it's their satisfaction, my satisfaction, and then the friendship and the camaraderie that is created with myself and my fellow artists within the shop. It's everything is all encompassing, you know, feel good type of profession.
Damon Butler is a tattoo artist at Empire Tattoo in Quincy. Damon, great to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.